Hey, it's Ron. This episode was recorded before I launched Politicology, when I hosted the Lincoln Project podcast on this feed. If you have questions, comments, or advice, you can reach us at podcast@politicology.com or find us online at politicology.com. Enjoy. Welcome to the very first episode of Republicans Defeating Trump. I'm Ron Steslow. I wanted to start off by introducing you to the rest of the founders. I sat down with each of them to capture who they are, what the Lincoln Project means to them, and why they think this movement is resonating with so many people. Let's start with George Conway. I didn't know George personally before we formed the Lincoln Project. In fact, like many of you, I really only knew two things about him: that he was married to Kellyanne Conway, who, as you know, was Trump's campaign manager in 2016 and one of the people most responsible for putting him in the White House, and that he's one of Trump's most vocal critics, particularly on Twitter. So I think, like everyone else, I was curious about what prompted his change of heart. So George, for people who may not know who you are, why don't you give us a little bit of your background?
I am George Conway. I'm a lawyer by profession and not a political professional. I grew up in Massachusetts, a liberal bastion, and I became a conservative my first year in college when Ronald Reagan was elected president. And I was a registered Republican from college until 2018, and I never voted for a Democrat in a major election. I think I voted once when I was in college for the communists, because the communist was the only opposition to Tip O'Neill at the time. But other than that, I voted straight Republican for 38 years. And, you know, I went to law school, I became a lawyer, and I just practiced law from the time I graduated from law school. I clerked for a conservative federal judge who was actually on Ronald Reagan's short list to be on the Supreme Court. But unfortunately, he was number two on the Justice Department list and number two on the White House list. And so they ended up picking Ginsburg, who went down, and then they ended up picking Anthony Kennedy. So I've been in law school. I was the president of the Yale chapter of the Federalist Society, the conservative lawyers group. And I am on, still to this day, I am on the board of visitors of the Federalist Society, which has nothing to do with the present enterprise here. And that's basically my life. I just practiced law. I did have some pro bono activity along the way, which included ghostwriting all of Paula Jones's briefs and making it all the way to the Supreme Court, and where we won. And the basic principle there, which was motivating me as much as thinking that Bill Clinton was a sleazeball, was that no man is above the law.
Yeah. So you are really the quintessential conservative attorney, if ever there were one.
Yeah. Yeah, not quintessential in the D.C. sense, because I think the lawyer, I was a lawyer in New York. The lawyers in D.C. tend to go in and out of the government. I never did that. I just spent 30 years just practicing law in New York and kind of minding my own business, except for that little foray into the Paula Jones case.
Can you tell us why you decided to help create the Lincoln Project?
Well, I was a little bit of a late joiner to the Lincoln Project. I can tell you how I came about that Rick and Steve and Reed came to approach me. I mean, I became a big Trump critic on the internet, or specifically on Twitter and in some op-eds. And obviously it was of some note because of who my wife is. We came to Washington after 38 years after she got Donald Trump elected. And I actually had accepted a position in the administration. Jeff Sessions had asked if I would run the civil division of the U.S. Department of Justice, which is basically the biggest law firm in America. And I was preparing to do that and filling out my forms and went through the FBI background check. And I started dragging my heels on filling out the financial forms, even though those are pretty easy since we'd really done them for Kellyanne already. I was watching this shit show in a dumpster fire. And I was just like, do I want to do this? how could I possibly want to do this? And I still supported the president at that point because I figured, all right, well, you know, he'll get better. He has to get better. And then he never did. And it was very frustrating to watch. And I kept wondering, well, what is his problem? Why does he keep doing these things? Why can't he just do the job and focus on it? If he did that, the economy is going great. He'd be fine. He doesn't actually have to do that much. But he keeps screwing it up by saying ridiculous things and doing ridiculous things. And then I realized he's nuts. I started reading about what the psychiatrists and the psychologists said about him. And it was, you know, I hadn't taken psychology in college like some people, but I learned a little about it. And I read the diagnostic criteria for the personality disorders that he had. And he checks the box for every single one of them. And I realized that, you know, somebody who is this narcissistic, who can only think of himself at any given moment, is always thinking about how he can promote himself and, you know, get the cheers of the crowd, of the people who like him, and is resentful of the people who don't necessarily like him. Presidents have to persuade others to join their cause. You have to work with the people who don't necessarily agree with him. He's incapable of doing that. And he's incapable of focusing on the interests of the nation, as we saw during the Russia investigation. He did everything he could to obstruct that when he should have been saying, gee, the Russians did this. Maybe they tried to help me, but this is not good for the country, so I have to stand up for the country. He didn't do that. He tried to obstruct the investigation, which was criminal. He should have been impeached for that. And then, of course, the Ukraine matter. He just basically took the power of the office, the power of overfunding, to try to extort a benefit for his own reelection. But so somewhere along the line, I came to realize this guy was never going to cut it. And not only was he never going to cut it, he's affirmatively dangerous because he has no respect for the rule of law.
So what is it about this moment, this election, that first makes the Lincoln Project so important, but also what is it about this moment that you think has drawn so much attention to this movement? Why has it been so successful?
I think the reason why this moment is so critical is that Donald Trump isn't just a bad president, an incompetent president, a madman. He is a corrupter. He's corrupting the government. He's corrupting the political system. He's corrupted an entire political party that consists of many well-meaning people, some not so well-meaning, but people who ought to know better. And there are so many people who just wish he would go away and wish they could swap out somebody else in a heartbeat, but they won't say anything. They won't do anything. I mean, there was a poll the other day that said that 23% of Republicans wish someone else were their nominee, which is just an incredible statistic. And I'm sure that the number is actually higher than that, because I think just people are conditioned now in the Republican Party to say, well, either you're for us or against us. And that's the fundamental problem. What this should be about is not us versus them, but right versus wrong. What is right and what is wrong? And for too many people, they've stopped thinking about right and wrong, and they're just thinking about, well, they're bad. The other side is bad. And yes, we disagree philosophically with the other side at times, but the fact is, what binds us together with the other side is far more important and far more essential than what sets us apart. We may disagree on some major issues. It may be abortion. It may be tax cuts. It may be some aspects of foreign policy. But we all believe in democracy. We believe in freedom. We believe in freedom of the press. We believe in impartial justice. So much of these things that Donald Trump could not give a damn about. As long he only cares about what helps him. And yet people overlook that. They're just his words. Oh, look at what he does. Well, what he does is no better. And people are just forgetting about right versus wrong. They've thrown up their hands and they just decide, I'm just going to decide the other side is evil about everything. And I'm not going to trust a thing that they say. And I'm going to cast my lot in with this man which is just appalling because he is a bad man, but he's also a very dumb man. And people are sacrificing, they are substituting this kind of blind loyalty for thoughtfulness. And again, as I say, it should be right versus wrong and not us versus them. And people should be thinking for their own and not assuming that somebody they disagree with 80% of the time is wrong 100% of the time. It turned out that the people I disagree with 90% of the time are right 100% about Donald Trump. In fact, they frankly understated the problem.
What we're trying
to do, or at least what I think the Lincoln Project is trying to do, is not only to get rid of Donald Trump, but to get rid of the cancer that is spreading throughout the body politic that he's either initiated or he caused it to metastasize. Exactly right. And the way to do that, unfortunately now, is basically to inflict losses on the Republican Party, to punish the Republican Party for what it has become and what it has chosen to tolerate. And I particularly think of the Senate, which is a major focus of our activities, and how senators who absolutely knew better, voted to acquit him of crimes that he clearly committed. And only one Republican senator, had the courage to vote for what was right, which is just astounding. One out of 53. That's just astounding and appalling. And for them, it was all about holding together as a club. And they didn't even think for one minute about the oaths that they took, other than Senator Romney. They clearly made up their minds, virtually all of them, from the beginning. And others probably just pretended to. And I just don't understand that. I don't understand why someone who has the courage to run for the United States Senate and be elected, and it takes a lot of courage to run for public office, can't have the courage to do the right thing.
Sure does.
And be remembered in history for doing the right thing. But that's where we are today.
Yeah.
Where United States senators are afraid. And well, this part of this effort is to make them afraid of something else. Make them afraid to do the right thing as opposed to sticking up for a corrupt president.
Reed Galen is the captain of the ship. I've known Reed and worked with him for many years, especially on efforts to reform some of the most broken pieces of our political system. Now, neither of us had changes of heart about Donald Trump because we never supported his candidacy in the first place. But Reed and I are among those George mentioned who feel like we no longer have a voice in the GOP. In fact, we both share similar views about the future of the Republican Party. But that's a topic for another episode. So, Reed, would you mind giving us a little bit of your background for those who may not be familiar with you?
Sure. I was born into politics. Other kids went to summer camp, and I went to the National Republican Congressional Committee. So it probably explains a lot about why I am and who I am at this point. From, the 80s through the early 90s, I spent a lot of my summers up there really, getting to see firsthand how all the political stuff worked. Then I went to the University of Texas at Austin and started interning for then Governor George W. Bush. And I was lucky enough to work for him on the 2000 campaign. I was privileged enough to work at the White House in 2002 and then on his reelection in 2004. Subsequent to that, I worked for folks like Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger from California, Senator John McCain from Arizona on his presidential campaign, and then spent a lot of time doing other things, ballot measures, reform-minded stuff, voter access, redistricting reform, those sorts of things. So I've been doing this as long as I can remember.
Why did you help create the Lincoln Project?
So, as I mentioned previously, I spent my entire life and career in Republican politics. And come 2016, when Donald Trump won the nomination, it was just the straw that broke the camel's back. And for me, it was the idea that if this is what it took to win with Republicans at the national level, then that just wasn't me anymore. I was always, you know, very moderate. You know, when Donald Trump calls us rhinos, I'm probably the last of the rhinos, maybe. But, you know, last September, Steve and John and Rick and I got on the phone and said, okay, there are a lot of folks who are doing stuff in this space, but they don't necessarily have the ability or the skills, or frankly, maybe most importantly, the willingness to take Donald Trump on the way you're going to need to take him on to beat him this coming November. And so, you know, we wanted to do something that was a little bit different. This is a political organization, not a policy organization. We understand that to beat someone like Donald Trump and his campaign, who's going to have a lot of money and no scruples, you're going to have to take the fight to him. You're going to have to take it to him every day, and you're going to have to keep him distracted such that he cannot really focus his fire at this point now on someone like Vice President Biden, because he's so wrapped up with people from his own party ostensibly attacking him regularly.
So there was really no one else who you saw on the playing field who was willing to step up in this way.
Well, you know, let me speak for myself here. So I think there are a lot of folks in the you know, let's call it the center right, the conservative, or even the Republican space, who consider themselves anti-Trump, but not anti-Republican. And I think that that's a tough place to be, because from my perspective anyway, the two are now inextricably tied and will be for the foreseeable future. And so I think that's why you see that we decided that not only did Donald Trump need to go, but his worst enablers like Susan Collins or Cory Gardner or Martha McSally need to be washed out of the system as well, because they have shown that they will do whatever it takes to save themselves, you know, in the name of political expediency, when bad behavior, unpresidential behavior, and frankly, unfitness for office is staring them in the face. And I don't believe that that mission will be over on November 3rd when we beat Trump and all these people. I think that the party has fundamentally changed. And from our perspective, you know, it is not a healthy political organization anymore. It is not one that looks out for, from its own philosophical perspective, for the good of all Americans. It is now a group of people dedicated to assuming power, gaining power, growing power, and doing things for their own benefit. And we have a name for things like that, and they're called gangs.
So, Reed, what is it about the moment that we find ourselves in right now? When you look around at the political spectrum, at the landscape, in 2020 or in 2019 in December when we launched, what is it about right now that makes the urgency of the Lincoln Project so poignant?
So I think when we launched last December, we had these high-minded ideals about saving the Republic from Trump and Trumpism. And they are still with us today. He does not choose to lead the American people. By all accounts, he does not want to lead the American people. I think he likes being president. I think he likes the deference that comes along with that and the power that comes along with that. But I don't think he sees it as service or responsibility. Clearly, he said that. And so, you know, as we started this campaign, you know, we went straight from launch into impeachment, which was just such an illustration and brought into just such broad relief just who Donald Trump was, right? It wasn't just that he had done these things vis-a-vis Ukraine or Joe Biden. It was that he thought that because he's the president of the United States, nothing, no law applies to him, and no action because he took it is unpresidential. And I think from a broader perspective, we saw that in the Republican Senate, that they had decided that they were going to hitch their wagons to Donald Trump's star, and I think that that's likely to be very damaging to them this year, as we're seeing. But what really brought in the importance of defeating Trump was when the COVID crisis struck, because it's very easy to say, well, I voted for Donald Trump in 2016. You know, I didn't like Hillary Clinton because I hadn't liked her for a long, long time. And look, the guy's a joke, yeah, but the economy's strong, unemployment is very low, my 401k is through the roof, the stock market is through the roof, my taxes have gone down. It's all very easy to say that when it doesn't matter that there's a clown in the Oval Office. But you don't hire presidents for the good times. you hire presidents to deal with the bad times and the hard times. And what we're seeing now is that this is, you know, between the Civil War and World War II and name any other number of things, we're dealing with one of the greatest crises in American history. And this individual, Donald Trump, has neither the desire nor the ability to do the job he needs to do, which is serve as administrator in chief and bring all the resources to bear that are necessary to help solve this problem, conciliator in chief, to be a uniter of all Americans, regardless of whether or not they're Republican, Democrat, or otherwise, and someone who understands the serious nature of what's going on and is listening to the experts trying to tell him what must be done. And so what it brought back to us is something that seems overstated until we're in a moment like this. Politics is a life and death business. When things go wrong, they go wrong in a hurry. And if you have the wrong captain at the tiller who saw the iceberg, said, "I don't believe it," and runs into the iceberg, then backs the boat up and runs into it again, I think we clearly know that this is someone who neither deserves the office nor is capable of performing the duties required of it. And I think a lot of us have known that since long before he ever took the oath back in 2017. But even more so now, why from a life and death perspective, from a human toll perspective, and from an economic perspective, another 4 years of this president is going to have a devastating impact on the country.
I'm really excited for you to meet Mike Madrid because he brings a unique perspective, not just personally as a Latino Republican, but on America's changing demography and the Republican Party's complete failure to appeal to minority communities. Hey, Mike, would you mind starting by telling our listeners a little bit about your background and the work you've done?
So my work really began in college, volunteering Republican congressional campaigns. I grew up in a little town called Moorpark in Ventura County, right in the heart of the northernmost part of Southern California, in the shadow of the Reagan Library. You could literally see the Reagan Library from my front lawn. So, you know, there's a lot of Republicanness in the area of America that I came from. And on those first campaigns, I was afforded a lot of opportunities to meet a lot of folks, a lot of influential people. I became an appointee of Governor Pete Wilson's community college board as a student, overseeing the largest community college system in the country. I worked in Governor Wilson's office when I went to Georgetown to finish my undergraduate work and started studying Latino politicization. So, you know, I've worked again as the political director of the California Republican Party. I worked as press secretary for the California Assembly Republican Leader, worked for a number of different independent efforts electing Republicans around the country. We actually did some work in Florida for Jeb Bush's reelection as governor. I did a lot of work with Texas and Texans firms, and I saw how the Texas Republicans dealt differently with issues than we did in California. A lot of my 20s, like a lot of political operatives, was spent kind of in a plane, living out of a suitcase and just doing Republican campaigns all over the place. And ultimately, when I settled down and started raising a family, I recognized that DC was probably not going to be my first choice to raise a family. It's one of my better decisions, I think. What I ended up doing was realizing that California was my home, and it was the area that I wanted to watch this changing demography unfold and see if the Republican Party could do the right things to welcome and engage and grow conservatism and grow free market ideals and grow constitutional principles with a people that maybe didn't have that same cultural inclination, that same background. And I've seen a lot of things work and I've seen a lot of things not work. And it's very clear that America is on the cusp of these same changes. And the Republican Party nationally is making a lot of the same mistakes that it was making in California. And the great fear, I think, is that we are on the verge of losing a lot of what it is that we bring to the table in the public arena because we simply cannot get past a number of key critical issues as a party.
So, Mike, you've spent your entire career electing Republicans, not just in California, but all around the country. So Why did you decide to be a part of the Lincoln Project, and what does it mean to you?
When a number of us first started having discussions about the idea of a Lincoln Project, a number of questions kind of arose. What is the intent? What is the purpose here? Are we trying to reform the Republican Party? Are we trying to save the party? Are we trying to influence the party? A lot of these movements, you know, as an activist, as a political professional in the Republican Party, you've seen a lot of these things come and go. The immediate answer was, of course, that we had something to do first and foremost. Before we started talking about the future, we needed to remedy what is happening in the present. The fact that this presidency presents itself as a clear and imminent danger to our republic was something that was not lost on any of us. And the importance of setting everything aside as our profession, of our professional networks, of our businesses, of our reputations needed to be set aside in order to take care of what we believed was the foundational challenge, and that is our Constitution is under attack. Our country and its institutions are being undermined. And we believe to our core that we have the ability, each of us, to make a difference in the outcome of this race. And at that point, we have an obligation, right? We have an obligation to act. And so regardless of the cost to us personally and professionally, reputationally, the immediacy of the challenge was not lost on any of us. Now, the question of what the Lincoln Project could mean going forward and why it is such a unique effort at this moment in time in American history, I think can be answered by the fact that the Republican Party and the demography of our country is changing. This is the first time in American history, the very first time where a dominant culture, a people of white European ancestry will be leaving an America to a non-majority white country. And while not all of this is about race, it's undeniable that a lot of it is. The very identity of America is changing. And I believe it's the obligation for those of us who believe in constitutionalism, who believe in the principles of self-governance, who believe in the republic that was founded, we have an obligation to reach out, to inform, to lead, to educate, to talk about these principles so that the next generation of Americans can carry this mantle on into this next American century. What I have seen, unfortunately, what I have experienced and what I have watched is that the fear of a new America is forcing not only our party, but parts of America into decline. What we're watching is something extraordinarily different than what attracted me to the Republican Party in the first place. I was brought into the party by Ronald Reagan's optimism, by his growth, by his vision of what America could be as it expanded. The idea of making America great, which again was part of his campaign thematic in 1980, the idea of making America great was expansive. It was visionary. It was the idea that we had principles that we could share with the rest of the world. And a country that is growing, a country that is sharing, a country that is imparting, is a country that is positive, is a country that is aspirational, it is a country that is optimistic. What we have seen in the last 30 years as this economic and even our demographic transformation has changed our Americanness, or challenged it, I should say, many of the same members of this group have taken a much more dystopian view of what America is and what it's going to be. The idea of making America great has become regressive. It's backward thinking. It's trying to hearken back to the past, which we all know as human beings, you can't go back to the past. You have to either boldly go towards a more optimistic future or have to accept your own decline and work to tear down her institutions, America's institutions. And unfortunately, that's what we're witnessing right now. And I can't be party to that, nor can the other members of the Lincoln Project. And we've decided to spend this chapter of our lives making sure that we can come to bear a new witness, a new presence for our American identity, and hopefully lead conservatism, republicanism, and America into a more positive, aspirational view of who we are becoming.
Let's go to John Weaver next. In the insular world of political strategy, John needs no introduction. But if you don't know him by name, you definitely know him by his work at the highest levels for many household names and heroes of the Republican Party for decades. So, John, for the folks who may not already know who you are, if they're not hyper politically engaged and haven't been following politics around the country, right? how would you describe your your background and the years of work you've put into the Republican Party, Republican causes, and what brought you to this moment?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Ron. I've spent over 30 years in the Republican Party and the Republican movement. I began as in Young Americans for Freedom way back in college, which was a conservative youth organization behind the growth of the Reagan campaign in 1980, in support of Ronald Reagan's efforts to get elected president and his policies, particularly his foreign policy. Got very fortunate to get involved in politics at a high level as a young person. Managing a congressional race, a deputy manager of a successful U.S. Senate race in Texas. And that was back in the day when Texas was a two-party state, which it is about to become again, and was asked to run the Bush campaign for Bush 41 in Texas in 1988.
And, wow.
And was reported directly to Jimmy Baker. And my career kind of grew from there. So I've been involved in presidential politics almost every election cycle, worked for President Bush 41 twice. I ran John McCain Political World for 11 years, was his strategist in the 2000 reform campaign that nearly won the nomination, and then ran John Kasich's campaign for president. In 2016 against Donald Trump in the primary, we were the last candidate in the race standing against him. And then along the way, also, like everybody else, worked in a handful of gubernatorial, U.S. Senate, congressional campaigns. And over time, you have the enthusiasm of youth. And I can look back on it now, Ron, you're much younger than I am, but we look back on it now, I feel like I was a Bernie Madoff salesman. I was out there promoting our goods and our wares and our policies. And then you wake up one day, you read the news, it dawns on you that it was all a big fat lie, that we didn't care about character, and we didn't care about responsibility, and we didn't care about the Constitution or the rule of law, and we didn't seem to care about a cogent national security policy or free trade or freedom in the, freedom in the expansion of freedom beyond the liberal democracies that were our allies. And speaking of allies, we didn't really care about them either. And so the careerism and the cowardice of the current party leadership, and by that I mean those in Washington, in the Senate, in the House, in many, but not all, governor mansions around the country, on down to state legislatures, where they have become either silent in the face of Trumpism or have become full-throated acolytes, clearly push me and radicalize me. I use that term to the point that I now believe, while there's a need for a center-right party in our country, one that's been hollowed out by, to its core, and devoid of principles, needs to be burned to the ground, and we need to start over. So that's my journey in a nutshell.
Yeah, that is probably, so far, the story that rings the most familiar for me, the salesman realizing that it was all a lie.
I don't know how many holidays and birthdays and important family events I missed in order to be a salesman for the cause, and the cause meant nothing.
Yeah.
I'm not a victim here. I did it willingly.
Sure.
But we have to make up for it now.
Speaking of waking up, making up for it now, I think one of the strengths of the Lincoln Project and what makes it so unique and special in the space and the moment that we're in right now is that all of us have taken our own paths to this project, and they're not all the same. We've come from different backgrounds and have all arrived at the same decision to pursue the same mission right now. So can you talk a little bit about what that journey was like for you? What does it mean to you to be a founder of the Lincoln Project?
Well, I'm extremely proud. When I picked up the phone and called Rick and Steve and suggested we do this, and without hesitation, they agreed. I knew that they had, just from a distance, just from reading and listening to what they had to say, I knew that they had arrived at the same point. I think the thing that's most gratifying is, while I knew that we had, crossed the Rubicon, so to speak, you really don't know how many people are with you. And once we formed with your help and you signed on, and we launched with the New York Times op-ed in December and got her voice on social media. The fact that millions of people have responded, yeah. hundreds of thousands of people have signed on. I get stopped now by people before the pandemic in the streets or at airports saying, "Hey, aren't you involved with the Lincoln Project? Keep going."
Yeah.
That's what's gratifying is that we know that we're not in this alone. And I know talking to just rank and file Americans who signed on with us or support us, they're encouraged to know that, hey, I was a former Republican or I was a former independent. I'm disgusted by, you know, whatever actions led them to that point. And I'm glad to know that there are others just like us.
Yes.
I think that's the most gratifying.
That they're not alone. Yeah. Right. So what is it about this moment? Because I think we could have had this conversation last year or the year before that or the year before that. But what is it about the moment that we find ourselves in right now in 2020 with a November that is looming larger than maybe any other, it feels like any other in history? What is so significant about this moment and its urgency?
Well, we could have had this conversation anytime the last 3 years. But look, Ron, this is not a time of our choosing. We didn't go out and look for this fight. It came upon our doorstep, right? And this is the most consequential election, at least in my mind, since Lincoln's reelection in 1864. Much was hinging on that. The America that we have in our mind's eye that has drifted a bit away under Trump's lack of leadership the last 3 years is fully on the ballot in November. And if we're successful, and I believe Joe Biden is a good and decent man, but if we're successful, we can get back to the business of moving America forward in a progressive manner. And if we fail, the consequences are dire. I think most Americans now agree with that. I don't think this is going to be an election where we worry about turnout. This is an election where we worry about persuasion. And so far, I'm encouraged by that.
I think we're going to have plenty of time for plenty of conversations about just what the consequences look like if God forbid, Donald Trump gets another term. But for now, thank you for sharing.
Thank you, Ron, and thanks everybody for participating and joining and listening.
Rick Wilson is another one of the founders I've worked with before. We helped defeat Roy Moore during the Alabama Senate race. Now, Rick is a best-selling author, one of Trump's fiercest critics, and is well known as one of the most effective ad makers in political media. Most importantly, he oversees the production of the Lincoln Project's ads, which, since you're listening to this, you already know, they are sometimes blistering, sometimes funny, sometimes poignant, but they are always resonant, and they've caused millions of Americans to mobilize against Donald Trump. So, Rick, for those who may not know of you, and there's a lot of folks in the political world who already do and have been following you for a long time, but for those who don't, can you give us a little bit of your background, how long you've been doing this, and exactly what you do in politics?
Sure, Ron. I came into politics in 1987. That's how old I am. And they jokingly say in politics, you'll last as a consultant about 7 years before you burn out or want to sleep at night or have a family or a pet or anything else. Somehow, I've been around this game for 30 years now. And I joined my very first campaign. I went to work for a guy named Connie Mack in Florida, who was running for U.S. Senate. And through a series of moments of absolutely, just dumb political luck. And although I am an empiricist, I have seen so much luck in politics over my lifetime. I've come to actually believe in it. I ended up becoming a field director for the Bush campaign in 1988 in Florida. We did very well. I got to learn my state like I had never imagined I would. Then went to Washington for 4 years as an appointee, and jumped over from transition to work for this guy some people know of named Dick Cheney when he was Secretary of Defense. And I did that and worked in the national security side for my period of appointment in the first Bush administration. Came back to Florida and worked briefly in the state Senate because I was a good crisis manager. I had spent 4 years doing that at DOD, and one thing led to another. I've had a family connection. My wife at the time was pregnant out to yay. I needed a gig after Bush had gotten beaten by Clinton, and so came back to Florida, did that for a little bit, and then went into consulting, and had a very swift and I'm delighted rise in the consulting world, moving up from state House, state Senate races in a few months to doing congressional and U.S. Senate campaigns. My first big campaign, the mega campaign as a consultant, in December of 96, my partner and I got the job of doing Rudy Giuliani's reelection campaign in New York.
Wow.
And I will tell everyone listening, that was a very different Rudy than we see today. That was a very, very different man. But I from there, I helped the 2000 Bush campaign, and I've done U.S. Senate races, governor's races, House races, ballot initiative campaigns, races here and abroad. And I've been very fortunate to spend a long time in a field where I elected very liberal Republicans in purple states and managed to get, moderate Republicans in blue states, and did a whole bunch of things that showed me that the party as it once was had this spectrum of ideological flexibility. And that doesn't mean you're betraying your principles. That means you're running the right person for the right state.
Right.
I'll give you an example. We helped reelect a governor in Vermont, reelect a governor in Vermont several times. Was he a rock-ribbed, far-right Tea Party conservative? No, he was not. Was he perfect for Vermont? Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. And the question always, with these, hardliners who were coming up after the Tea Party, it was always, do you want a Republican of any kind or a Democrat?
Yeah.
And the answer increasingly, unfortunately, and it should have been kind of a warning to us. Mm-hmm. The answer was increasingly, no, I don't want anybody who's not completely like me. Mm-hmm. And so we have this ideological homogenous nature that started creeping in around 2010, where a Republican in South Florida had to be just like a Republican in Middle Alabama.
Yeah.
And a Republican in New York had to be just like a Republican in Eastern North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And the homogeneous nature of it was that they all had to be on the furthest Tea Party checklist extreme. Now, we used to win races. We won, this. You've been around the block. We won almost 2,000 seats in 20 years.
Yeah.
At every level. And I mean, from dog catcher to U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
Because we didn't make everybody walk the plank on every issue.
Right.
And one of the reasons that Trumpism appealed to that Tea Party remnant, that Tea Party faction, was he told them, no, I'll burn everything down. It's all going to be about me now. There's no more ideology. Yeah. There's no more philosophy. Yeah. There's no more underpinning to it.
Yeah.
It's about me.
So working in this business and working for so many different candidates, causes, initiatives for Republicans, for conservatives, and seeing the breadth of the ideas that are sort of welcome under this umbrella, or at least were for so long. What is it about your journey, and where did it take a turn? And really what I'm looking for is, what was it that brought you to the Lincoln Project? Why did you want to create this movement, given everything that you've experienced and worked for so long?
Well, I had, even before Donald Trump came on the scene, I was convinced, as one of the autopsy guys, and in Republican circles, folks, the autopsy was a report we put out after 2012 that said, what do we do to save this party? And it had things like, we've got to do a much better job of talking to Hispanics. We've got to do a much better job with African Americans and not just talk the talk. We need to do all these things to reach out to people, to let them know there's a diversity of opinion in our party, that the big tent is real and everyone is welcome. And the Ronald Reagan dictum of my 80% friend is not my 20% enemy. And so even before then, I recognized we were reaching an inflection point where the Fox News effect, the Breitbart effect, this whole siloing of our different media cultures was having a very negative effect that would eventually redound to our harm. We saw that you know, there was a field of people who represented a whole spectrum of possible outcomes for the GOP, many of which I thought were going to be dangerous, and they were. And Trump has managed to be everything we feared and more. And so one of the reasons that I was, you know, when we started talking about this, gosh, I guess we were all talking back in the fall, late fall of last year, you know, all of us had been on our journey sort of fighting against Trumpism and the ugliness and the depravity and the corruption right. and the racism that is inherent to Trumpism.
Right. And most of us, it wasn't a single moment.
Right.
This was a gradual, holy shit.
Somebody asked me a question about this a while ago in an interview. And I remembered, somebody said, when did you start breaking with the sort of what is the Trump Party? And I said, you know, ironically, it was in 2014. Because, you know, I was one of the very early adopters in the GOP. I think it was 02 or 04. I got to go back and look. I put a briefing together for I think it was the RGA. It might have been the Senate. I don't remember who. And I said, you guys have got to get off this gay marriage question, because it's fundamentally not a conservative response. And I said, the social idea of a party that promotes marriage but thinks that government should be involved in deciding which consenting adults can fall in love and get married is ridiculous.
It's intellectually dishonest.
Yeah, completely. And I said at the time, I'm not being, you know, just opportunistic here, but society's changing. If you don't change with it, you're going to get on the backside of that curve. Well, in 14, I was quoted, I think, in Politico about it, and Rush Limbaugh lost his damn mind about me on the air. And I just thought at that moment, I was like, I am sick of having to pretend that this fucking guy represents my party.
Yes.
I'm sick of having to pretend that the big guy is an actual voice of conservative principle. He's a populist. He's a nationalist. And those things in my study of history lead to terrible fucking places.
Yeah.
Sorry, listeners. Yeah. I have a salty mouth. they lead to places that are never good for political and other minorities. They are never good. They always end up coming down to you're a true person of this country because of your blood or where you're from or what
the color of your skin.
What your skin looks like in the mirror. Mm-hmm. And you know, you and I both were raised in a country with people like Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, who talked about the fact that America was that shining city on the hill, that propositional country where it didn't matter where you came from. You could be born in Nepal or Sudan or Scotland. You come here, you become an American by becoming part of our system, by becoming part of what we believe. Yeah. And underneath Trumpism and the heartbreak for me, the heartbreak was the minute he starts talking, I'm going to shut the borders. We're going to stop all immigration. Oh, these people are rapists. They're murderers. And I just realized at that moment, like, this guy is a destructive, horrible force. There is no redeeming quality to Donald Trump, and there never will be. He will bring out the very worst in Americans because that's how he makes himself powerful, by causing himself to be surrounded by even shittier, more horrible people. And he wants a whole country of Trumps so that his own moral vacuum doesn't seem so horrific.
What is it about the moment that we're in? Taking all of that in view, what is it about the moment that we find ourselves in right now? Now, the Lincoln Project launched December 17th, 2019, just a few months ago. What is it about right now, the whether it's the danger of a second Trump term or the decades to come if he is reelected and the lessons the party's learned, what is so significant about the moment we find ourselves in that voters need to understand when they go to the ballot box in November?
They need to understand that although every election we're told this is the most important election in history, this really is the most important election in our lives. This is a decision between whether or not we are a representative democracy in a Republican form of government, or whether we slip into an authoritarian personality cult for the future. Because believe me, if it's Donald Trump for a second term, it's not going to go back to normal at the end of 2024. It's not going to reset and be the America we once knew.
Yeah.
Corrosive nature of Trump, the devastating mistakes he's made in our country at every level, from costing $102,000 by the time this podcast airs, who knows how high it'll have climbed, by having 102,000 of his citizens die without need, by having a corrupt administration that violates the rule of law every day. And while we're recording this, the president of the United States is saying, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, as just a capstone to his horrific racial games he has played since he came down that escalator. Yeah. Those are things that make this vote so consequential and so meaningful and so dangerous to this country. And it's one of the reasons the Lincoln Project is pushing so hard to shake voters into understanding the stakes we face and to shock them sometimes about the degree to which Trump is not normal, is not sane, is not just playing games, that it is not a game we can afford to lose. This is an election we have to win. This is an election that no matter what your ideological predicates or mine are, Joe Biden at his root, at his base, at his core, is not a figure of corruption and darkness and frankly, evil as Donald Trump is. Yeah. So it's a heavy fight. And, you know, we love working with together. All of us get along. I mean, all of us have worked together or knew each other in some capacity. But it is amazing how quickly this pirate ship of ours has gotten its bearings and is sailing into the.
It really is. In the scheme of campaigns, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Rick, thanks so much for coming on. Let's wrap up with Steve Schmidt. Steve is another one of the founders I didn't know personally before the Lincoln Project. Of course, I knew him by his work for Arnold Schwarzenegger and John McCain, and by his TV appearances. But one of the things I've come to appreciate about him is his readiness to zoom out and look at the chaos of the moment with a wider lens, always putting things into a historical perspective. So, Steve, for the listeners who may not be familiar with yourself or your background, can you give us an overview of your career in Republican politics?
Well, I've spent a lot of my career working in Republican politics. I was a journeyman campaign manager working all over the country at every level of politics in my 20s and ultimately wound up in California. And then from California, landed, like most of us do, in Washington. And you know, during those years, I was the communications director of the National Republican Congressional Committee, which is the campaign arm for House Republicans in the 2002 cycle, which was one of only three cycles at that point in 102 years that the incumbent presidential party had picked up seats. I became one of the top strategists on George W. Bush's reelection campaign. I served in the White House as deputy assistant to the president, counselor to the vice president. I ran the Alito and Chief Justice Roberts confirmation processes. I took over Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign in California in 06 and ultimately John McCain's in 2008 and have been involved for a long time at a deep level in electing Republicans all over the country.
Clearly, you've spent your entire career electing Republicans at all levels, all around the country. Can you explain why you helped create the Lincoln Project and what it means to you? And, you know, was this a difficult decision or was this something you had to do?
Donald Trump stands against everything that I've always believed in. I think that he daily assaults the integrity and the decency and the fabric of the country. I stand in opposition to him. I think he's brought us to an unprecedented moment of American weakness, his division of the country, his appalling desecration of the dignity of the office of the President of the United States. And so I'm delighted to have been able to have the opportunity to be one of the founders of an effort that's going to work hard to try to make sure he's a one-term president.
What is so significant about the moment that we're in right now And why is the urgency of the Lincoln Project? What do you think that's contributing to its resonance around the country?
Well, I think what the Lincoln Project is doing is making sharp arguments that are impeaching Donald Trump's tenure as president of the United States and communicating with people in language that they plainly understand about what his deficiencies in office are. And, you know, I think that people look at this moment, they know the only way to get rid of Donald Trump is to vote him out of office. And so I think that people recognize intuitively this is an important election. And historically, I mean, for people that are fluent with the history of the country, bar none, this is the most important election America's had since the presidential election of 1864, which fundamentally decided whether we were going to be a country or not anymore.
I want to take a moment to talk about the cult of personality that we're fighting when we say Trumpism. You see, Donald Trump's worst nightmare is Republicans turning against him. And those Republicans who are wrestling with their consciences because they know this man is dangerous, that he is a threat to our Constitution, and that another 4 years would be catastrophic for America. See, if they voice that concern from within the echo chamber of the Trump machine, they're made to feel alone. Or worse, they're ridiculed as a traitor. And that is fundamentally un-American. Thanks to the millions of people who are helping to amplify our message at the Lincoln Project, those people are now seeing that they are not alone. If you're familiar with our founding members, you'll notice that there's been one important voice missing from this episode, and that's Jennifer Horn. But rest assured, you can look forward to hearing from her very soon. Our next episode will feature a more in-depth conversation with George Conway before and after his decision to fight Donald Trump. And we'll also talk about the upcoming Supreme Court decisions that will have a major impact on presidential power. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, because it helps more people find us. We'll be dropping new episodes every week to amplify the truth, offer our political expertise, and share the stories of fellow American patriots who are putting country over party. I'll see you on the next episode. This episode was recorded when I hosted the Lincoln Project podcast on this feed. If you have any questions or advice, you can reach us at podcast@politicology.com. And please know that even if we don't respond, we read every email we get, and we love hearing from you. If you enjoy the show, it would help us if you could rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ron Steslow.